This meeting of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, February 13th. Happy early Valentine's Day. Members present are Representative Costello, Representative Edgman, Representative Rauscher, Representative Kopp, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Donna Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence their cell phones. As a reminder, staff and members of the audience, please don't approach the table. Our committee aide, Ariel Svetlik, will be able to help you as she's helping me right now. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, our House Energy Committee Secretary, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support today. We're spending a lot of time together today, Zach. Today, the committee will hear from Director Curtis Thayer of the Alaska Energy Authority with support from Connor Erickson. Mr. Thayer will wrap up the presentation that we started on January 23rd, and then we'll continue with a deeper dive into the Renewable Energy Fund. I'm looking forward to that. Since the last time we met, we have a new list from round 17, and I'm looking forward to learning more about what those projects are. Mr. Thayer, please approach the table, put yourself on the record, and we'll get to it.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. My name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And we divided this presentation into two parts. Connor Erickson, who is our Director of Planning and responsible for the Renewable Energy Fund, will take the second half, a little bit more in-depth detail of the process and how we got to the recommendations that were forwarded to the legislature. Where we left off was renewable energy and energy efficiency within the Alaska Energy Authority. Our programs within the renewable energy program, we have several public outreaching, anywhere from electric vehicles to solar, wind, wood energy, working groups that consist of working groups from across the state. And some of them are small in nature, but some of them usually entertain 50 or 60 people at some of these working groups. With renewable energy and our energy efficiency programs, we really focus on the various types of renewables, whether it be biomass or electric storage or BESS's, geothermal, heat recover, hydro. We have our toe in nuclear. That's more of a university role, but we see that nuclear could be an option in the future, maybe in some of the rural hub communities or such, and so obviously we work with the university on that in addition to solar and wind projects. Where we are with some of this, and this definitely has been a change since the last time we had met, but we received funding, the Alaska Energy Office did, for home energy and high efficiency rebate loan allocations, $74 million. 37 for home energy rebates, and then for electrification and appliance rebates. We have been working with the Alaska Housing Authority on this. This is one of those instances where, rather than us develop a program, let's modify a program that they have and use those synergies. So that's what we're doing. However, there's no match required on these fundings, but one thing is this also has been placed on pause by the Trump White House, and so this project we're right now pausing until we have guidance if this project is moving forward. The one thing I will note is the conditional award was received in January of 25, the same which was last month, and so this particular one was received late. They were trying to put money out the door before a new administration, so they got it out, but it was before January 20th. But again, a conditional award does not mean that we've signed a contract for it. Solar for All, this is another one of the projects that we did receive in April 2024 with AEA and Alaska Housing Finance as a partner of ours for $62 million. AEA was looking at doing community solar in disadvantaged communities, and Alaska Housing Finance was looking at developing residential rooftop solar in low-income households. And again, there's no match required on this funding, but this project has also been put on hold by the Trump administration. Grid Resilience Formula Grant Program. This was a formula fund. This is a formula fund that Alaska was to receive $60 million. We had awarded roughly $20 million to actually Golden Valley for three different projects on their Alaska Intertie and in their service territory, and that funding was put on hold. So, again, we don't know where we're at on the funding level on it. However, this has been in the process. This is something that was previously approved by Congress and signed by the previous president, and we have a grant agreement in place. And so this one, the funding is sitting there, but, again, it is on pause with the federal government. Black Rapids Training Site, this is another one we've worked on, Defense Community Infrastructure Project. This is actually Black Rapids, which is outside of Fairbanks, Golden Valley's territory. This is where we applied for a grant on their behalf. They were not eligible, but we were eligible. And it was to extend the transmission line 35 miles to Black Rapids, where they had a training ground using diesel. And the diesels were at end of life, and they were faced of either closing down the facility or extending the transmission line is $15.7 million. This is not affected by the freeze. This is still going on because this actually is through DOT, and there is no state match required. The one slide that I did not have in this packet and I did take out of the packet, and that was, is we did have the NEVI program, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, was $52 million in formula funds to the state, and that funding was not paused. It was suspended. Upon further review into this summer, and I'll just put a little cap on that, is we have been waiting 2 years to approve 9 charging stations within our allocation, and overall across the country there's $5 billion dedicated to this fund, and they had only managed to approve 52 projects in the whole country. So this would be one that would be understandably one that they want to look at. So whether they start it up again or there's different conditions we're seeing, but right now the NEVI program is not an active one that we're expecting. We won't have guidance until late this summer of what they're going to do next with that program.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher, did you have a question?
Thank you, through the chair. So I was wondering, how far out of Delta does the transmission line go?
It goes roughly, through the chair, it roughly goes to Delta itself, and then this continues down approximately 34 miles to the training center itself.
Follow-up? That's the project will go 34 miles to the training center. But how far out of Delta did it go? Does it start where it ended? In other words, where Fairbanks ends, how far out of Delta?
Through the chair, I don't know exactly where in Delta it is. The Golden Valley transmission line goes to Delta. This connects into that transmission line and goes further down the highway.
Right. Yeah, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I suspect that I just need to be reminded, but as we look at these projects and the updates here, I was looking for the earlier GRIP funding for the HVDC line, and I'm just trying to clarify in my own mind where we're at with that funding, if that is also at all tied up in the current situation with the funding, and also the amount that we need to be looking at for this year's budget, which I understand would be in a capital appropriation, but how much that one was. So if you just refresh me on where we're at with that and whether or not that's tangled up in the same issue of suspended or not.
Right. Chair Holland, thank you for the question. In our previous presentation, we included that in a different section of the presentation because it was part of what we call owned assets. So it wasn't in the renewable category. However, that funding was $206 million that we had received in a federal grant. The state last year appropriated $12.7 million towards a match of $206. The AEA, through bonds working with the utilities, appropriated $50 million of bonds that we had for work towards Bradley towards that effort. And we worked with bondholders on that for the simple reason is it's moving Bradley Power. So it was conducive. But that currently is on a pause right now with the federal government. That is one that they're looking at. That particular one, there's some nuances with that, and that money was appropriated and approved by 2 years ago by Congress and the President. We do have a signed grant agreement with with the Department of Energy on that to proceed. There is a pause, and so, but we've just got word that we had some reimbursements, and they're making payment on those reimbursements. Mm-hmm. So there's money. We're not being owed money. We have money coming in from that grant, which is good. And then we had this discussion at our board of directors, at AEA's board of directors. And since we have state and AEA money in the match section of it, depending on how long this is pauses, but our spend for the next 30 days or 90 days for engineering work and some procurement and early modeling is about $700,000. And we decided to move forward with using the state funds on that, because if we were to slow this down or wait 90 days, then we could lose a construction season or a whole season this summer. And so we wanted to keep that momentum going, but we do have funding to do that, only because there's a match piece that we have. So we are moving forward on it, but it's paused. But we're only moving to that 90-day window in which they will hopefully let us know. And also I'll say this, too, and that is in talking with the delegation, this is also what the president campaigned on, infrastructure and transmission. And this is two key components of this, as well are a lot of other states. And so we're pretty confident it's going to go forward, but again, we need to get the green light from them to say it's going forward. But they are paid. But we have billed them $250,000, and they did pay those bills yesterday.
Follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. You mentioned the $15 million bond utilization that's helping match this. Are you going to later be talking about, or maybe we can just introduce the issue now with the action just taken that's restructuring the $200 million of bond authority that you have in the 2022, I believe, action that was taken that's restructuring some of the use of that money to support Dixon Diversion and some of the other projects. Could you, or if it comes up later, it's fine, just kind of explain what's the intent behind that? I think there's some allocation of the interest off of those bonds to help. So I'm just curious about how that's going to be structured into these decisions and projects.
A little bit about the bonding funds. AEA bonded in 2022 when Bradley Lake was paid off. The utilities were still obligated to pay a debt service. What was a debt service now became excess payments of roughly $12.5 million for the next 28 years. And so at the time with the utilities, the governor, the attorney general, everybody, in the power sales agreement, there was a clause that allowed us to use it for what we call required project work. So we had to identify projects that would benefit Bradley and the ratepayers of Bradley, and so we did that. We went out to bond using the $12.5 million as now debt service again, and that $12.5 million was able to produce $166 million in bonding, and our original concept was 65% of that money would be used for transmission work, and we would have the balance of the 35% be used for BESS's or batteries on the system. And that was how we split the 166. And it was a recommendation. It ultimately, by bondholders and by that, it was up to the AEA board how that money is to be spent, since AEA is the one that took out the bond. But with that, and working with utilities, working with the bondholders, definitely the HVDC line provided redundancy, allowed additional power to move across the system, and it was kind of – and so we went to the bondholders, we worked with the utilities, and they – of the 166, we put $90 million towards what we call the SQ upgrade, Sterling to Quartz Creek down on the Kenai Peninsula. That is underway. Today there are people – actually tearing down the 115 towers and putting up new ones. That's happening today. It's happening for about 10 weeks. And it's a first phase of four phases. So that work is being done. So that $90 million was set aside. And then we worked with the utilities as Homer and has Chugach and MEA and soon to be Fairbanks are putting BESS's on their system, battery energy systems, that we obligated or moved $28 million over the next 15 years for those BESS's, and that was to help buy those BESS's down in a sense that wouldn't be on the ratepayers. We had bond money, we could do that. That left us with roughly $50 million, and through $20 million last year and $30 million this year for a total of $50 million to put towards that, towards the match of our federal funding. And so with the $50 million and the 12.7, that gives us roughly $63 million, and we need 206 total. But at least we have funding in the federal match for the next 2 years on that. And the interest earned on those bonds are retained with the project. They don't go back to the state because these are not state bonds. These bonds are not using the good credit of the state. It's actually being paid for and are backed by the revenue by the power sales agreement for the 4 cent power of Bradley. So the utilities are reimbursing AEA for those, or doing the debt coverage based on them getting 4 cent power for the next 28 years.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Since we're in the neighborhood of this topic, if we're looking at pauses, and certainly anything can get delayed a year for any reason, but as we appropriate money for things, if things get held for a year, often there's increased costs and opportunities. There's an opportunity cost for that money, and but there's also that money sitting there that can earn interest. I understand there might be a little bit more information on something we can do to keep that money within AEA rather than going back to the general fund.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Take the bond money off the equation, because that's AEA bonding money, and we are allowed to retain that interest. But one of the things is there's two items in the governor's budget that deal with language. One of them is that if the state gives general funds to a renewable project or like GRIP, that AEA be allowed to retain that interest and use it towards the project. So, you know, for example, $12.7 million was given last year that we were able to retain that interest. Normally, the interest that's earned goes back to the state. But again, we have projects, and so it was allowing us to keep that interest, again, for projects. The second one in the language was as far as tax credits. And that is if any of the AEA projects that we're working on earns federal tax credits, that those tax credits can be kept at AEA and be used against that project. Because now, if you have a tax credit, it goes back to the state. But if, and I'm just going to pull a number out, but Bradley or the Dixon expansion is a $350 million project. If we were to say you have to get 10% tax credit, which is low, but say 10%, that's $35 million. We would rather put it against the debt or against the cost of the construction to lower the cost of the project. And so that was just trying to keep these within the projects as a way to offset, kind of hedge inflation a little bit, but also make sure that the ratepayers on these projects are also getting the benefit of the money going back.
As we're seeing
on those projects.
As we're seeing benefits from the corporation, you know, stay within that. So I appreciate the indulgence going into some financial stuff, but we do have the DCCED budget that will be in front of us, and the things that we're discussing in committee, I think, may inform some information and discussions that we have in that area. So thank you for indulging on there. So planning, one of my favorite topics. Let's continue.
Well, with planning, I'm going to invite Connor Erickson, the director of planning, up. He's responsible for not only our power project fund, but our renewable energy fund. This is a sign. and renewable energy fund, as well as one of the 401D programs. So so when it comes to kind of overall activities, he's our key expert. So I have asked him to come down and testify, as he can walk you through the process, because he's solely responsible for the renewable energy fund. And I can be your Vanna White.
through the chair. My name is Connor Erickson, the director of planning. Thank you, Curtis. You can go next. AEA's electronic library, digital library, electronic library, whatever namesake you'd like to apply to it, is one of a newer facet of the authority. And what it does is it just tries to provide more transparency for the work that we've done, both past, present, and any work that would come through our agency that would be and should be available to the public. We launched it back in December 2023. It was financed through a combination of our own authority funds, as well as through the Denali Commission in partnership with them. We've seen a pretty big uptake in visitation to the library with respect to public interest, as well as the number of documents that have been made available on the site. So we started with just a couple thousand when it was initially launched, but now there's over at this juncture there's actually over like 14,000 documents that are made available, and we expect that number to continue climbing as we continue to digitize and make available those documents that were originally just in the form of hard copy. But we've been able to realize significant savings as a result of the library as well. When Curtis mentioned the GRIP project, we actually saw that we were able to go back into the library, our project manager on that, and see that there had been historical studies that we weren't even actually aware of at the time that looked at alternative transmission routes across the inlet. And so that gives us kind of a baseline to work from, and whether or not we need to go and revisit and perhaps update those studies, or if those are actually prudent and we can move forward with those, then that's something to be seen. But as you can see, it's definitely been a benefit to the program, to the authority. The Power Project Loan Fund Program is a long-standing...
Hold on a moment. Representative Edgeman.
Yes, sorry for interjecting a quick question. Impossible to ask how much of this is tied to the Susitna Dam.
To the chair?
The electronic library.
The content. I would have to get back to you on a percentage basis, but there is definitely a plethora of documents related to SUWA. All the documents that were contained in our list as well have been transferred over to the library, so you can find those. And we kind of want to make a one-stop shop as far as a repository is concerned for authority documentation.
But fairly safe through the chair to say that it's probably the largest sort of collection related to one project that you would have in all of this, and maybe a significant part of the entire collection. So, okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. The Power Project Fund Loan Program is a longstanding program that the authorities had. I believe it was established, my memory serves me right, 1993. What it does is provides working capital. It can also provide construction funding, or actually preliminary design as well as feasibility reconnaissance funding for a myriad of energy projects, like I said, all phases as well as all types of energy projects, including fossil fuel projects and renewable energy projects. Currently, the project, our current loan balance right now is about $31 million. We've got 15 loans, and those are spread fairly, equitably across all the different energy regions of the state. We had, as you may well be aware, kind of a low balance of the fund for the past couple of years, but given that one of the larger projects that we had encumbered funds for, they decided to withdraw and not to move forward. That's been able to recapitalize the program. So now we're sitting on a pretty healthy balance of around $9.6 million as of December. And it's a program whose interest is kind of contingent upon, what kind of other funding opportunities tend to be available, whether federal or otherwise. And just by virtue of its nature of being a loan program in the past couple of years, there's kind of a, two sides of the sword in the sense that, some people look to leverage it as far as cost matching to federal grants. But in a lot of instances, for small communities, a lot of the federal grants that came out didn't require any cost match. And so, the communities would obviously, when given the option to, go for a loan that you're going to have to pay back versus a grant, I'll let you decide which option you take. That's not to say that we haven't continued to see interest in the program.
We've got a couple of questions on that Power Project Fund. Representative Hall.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to clarify the last sentence on that slide. Says capitalization of the fund would allow for additional loans to be issued to support the increased demand. Is there a request that we're getting for additional capitalization, or is that an internal AEA ability to provide what looks like a intent or a desire for more capitalization here? It wasn't clear here whether this was asking for some money or just simply an internal ability that if you put more money in and you have the authority to do that, you could do more loans.
Yeah, through the our co-chair Holland, there's not a request to recapitalize the power project fund because we're standing at roughly $9.6 million. So we had a couple of loans come through that we have some in discussion. They want to pay off their balances early, so we're not asking for it. It's just a note off to the side for us.
Thank you.
And through the chair, just to add to that point, what we've witnessed in recent years is that those borrowers approaching us that are interested in the program, the amount of funding that they're requesting tends to be greater than that we've seen in the past. The last two loans that we've issued have been, approaching $5 million apiece. So that was kind of the intent of the statement, was to show that, even though we have $9 million that could support maybe, two projects potentially, depending on the magnitude of the request.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, just on clarification too, if a request comes in between $0 and $2 million, then that is something the loan committee that I chair would be responsible for. If it's $2 to $5 million, then it has to go through the loan committee and approved by our board of directors. And anything over $5 million has to come to the legislature for approval. So we have we've had a couple requested, $4.9 million.
Funny.
So my recollection from last year on this, that hopefully I get this term right, was the program was in abeyance because there was insufficient capital to be putting out loans, yet there was still a couple of projects on there that had some interest. Now that we're getting into the position of being recapitalized, is there more interest again, or is that word kind of need to get out that we're open for business again?
I can take that. We are actively going to be advertising the program again, in the sense that there is funding available. This particular slide shows the projects that are outstanding. It shows the interest rate. The interest rate fluctuates because it's a 52-month trailing average, and then our current balance and then initial balance for some loans. So we have a couple of large loans outstanding. You'll notice the Halung Nai Haida Corporation down in Prince of Wales. That's our largest loan at $18 million, which was approved by the legislature several years ago.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to getting updates on this, seeing what interest there is out there. This is certainly the kind of program that I think if we have it capitalized, similar to what the demand is, that will help encourage programs and provide a return to the state and not just as a grant program. So this is a great tool to have out there, and I want to see it funded appropriately so that we can use it. Please continue.
So the Renewable Energy Fund is a longstanding program, again, of the state. It was established in 2008. Over the last four rounds, the legislature's committed about $61 million in support of over 60 projects. And then, historically, when we look back over the program, we've got over 110 operational projects from those that were funded since the inception of the program, of which, that has led to the displacement of more than 100 million gallons of diesel per year. You can see here that it says 85 million gallons, but further on in the presentation, we'll note that there's been that number has since been updated because, the displacement occurs on an annual basis, and this was through when the study was conducted through 2022.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. When this program was started, Curtis, this may predate you a little bit, but when it was started in 2007, 2008, it just seemed to me that the renewable energy industry in Alaska was clearly at a fledgling status, sort of at the start. Where we're at today in 2025, you wouldn't be able to answer this precisely, of course, but the money that goes into that renewable energy grant fund, I've always viewed it as serving a number of purposes, of course, to help the individual applicants go through the design and feasibility study, sort of the front end part of, getting to project development, but also at a broader level that it's feeding into that fledgling renewable industry in Alaska. And to the extent that we can keep an eye on the individual projects, which are all important, but also the industry as a whole, I thought I'd just maybe put that out there for you to comment on or whatnot, because we're right now, we're on the heels of a lot of federal money coming into Alaska, but all of a sudden that's on pause. We think we're going to get all that sort of, you know, unlocked and back on us, back out, you know, on the street, so to speak. But your thoughts on moving forward and the need to continue to fund the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program based on that larger question of it, it's also feeding into, you know, sort of a little bit of a changing of the tide in Alaska in terms of energy production.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, you're spot on. I'm saying if there's one project that truly has a success record, it's this program right here. Because with all the programs that it has funded, and granted, not every project's successful, not every project's going to move forward, but until you do the feasibility and you know if it does, and when we look back on the projects, like currently we're funding the largest solar farm in Alaska. Currently, the two wind regimes, Little Susitna and Shovel up in Fairbanks, was funded with REF. Projects in Nome, Bethel, 85% of these programs go into rural Alaska. When we look at the two geothermal sites that are being looked at, REF money is involved in both of those. We have REF when we started talking about Dixon Inversion. There was REF money to the original study. For that. And so when you look at it as a whole and you look at 100 million gallons of diesel displaced, and then with the federal dollars, you have like Angoon or even Old Harbor on Kodiak, those projects were started and determined to be feasible, and it's only with federal funding can they get that threshold. But if we can get Angoon to be 100% renewable in that community and then even possibly provide heat in that community through the hydro project. But again, it started with this project. It started with the REF program. And it, you know, they had high contributions from the state, $50 million, $100 million at the very beginning. And then, you know, there was a period in the previous administration, there was no funding. Then we had a tight budget. And then in round 13, which is just 5 years ago, what we did is the $4.75 million, this was a program that we were allowed to keep the interest on. And so we used that, looked at old projects, looked at interest, and that's how we got to the first $4.75 million is we just reappropriated out of the fund to kick it off, and now it's been averaging $10 to $17 million a year. So really this program across the state has been a winner. And then, like I said, it's just generated hundreds of millions of federal and private funds actually to continue these projects on that wouldn't otherwise be done.
Thank you. Follow up.
Is there any interfacing that might occur between this program and the subsidiary created by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Green Bank, the program that's taking root?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, there are synergies. Matter of fact, when they did the Green Bank through Alaska Housing, there actually was a component, a PCN, an employee of ADA, of AEAs, that would help provide technical assistance on helping advise and make loans with the Green Bank in rural Alaska based on the history of some of the information we have. Because of these hundreds of projects, we have all the data on them. It's all in our library, but we have everything there. But yes, that is part of that synergy that we have with Alaska Housing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well,
good question.
Oh, quick one, and then we'll dive into it.
No, I don't know about quick, but try.
That was a prompt.
Thank you. I'm curious. In the case of Renewable Energy Fund, we're seeing the growth of the independent power producers doing projects kind of adjunct to a local utility in order to kind of restructure the flow of the funds for the power production and to protect the PCE. How does Renewable Energy Fund administration, how are you thinking about those projects? And is that even a factor that you're considering when you decide which projects in terms of whether this is coming through a utility trying to build a project on or whether it's a third party trying to run an IPP in order to create this new hybrid structure we're seeing?
Through the chair, I would be safe to say, and I'm going to give myself some leeway, conservatively, 90% of all IPPs in Alaska got money from the Renewable Energy Fund to find out, do we have a viable project? We've done that with Puppy Dog Lake, which is a large solar down on the Kenai Peninsula is an IPP. They have two successful solars up front, up north. But we've done that with all these projects is because how do they find out if they got a project that's viable? That's just like when I mentioned we have Shovel Creek and Fairbanks and Little Susitna, both wind projects. There's $4 million invested in those projects, $2 million, or maybe it's $2 million. But between those two projects to find out, and they're determining if they're going to be a viable IPP. So without the Renewable Energy Fund, we would not be – I don't believe we would be having the IPP success that we would have already because we're providing that initial funding to find out if those projects are viable.
Follow up.
Thank
you for that. It's helpful. The other piece of this that you can probably anticipate from our earlier discussion is how the Emerging Technology Fund could be used as a tool to help out with some of the earlier stage technologies. And I'm curious what your thinking might be right now in terms of should we consider bringing that back again in order to help early stage technology evaluation and to help de-risk some of the Renewable Energy Fund projects?
Mr. Chair, you know, that fund sunsetted several years ago, and it sunsetted because I don't believe that people thought that it was a viable program in what it offered at the time. So without knowing and seeing what a new program might look like, I would say the old one didn't work as well. And also, here's the question. In Department, a lot of money federally have invested on these new technologies. So we don't need new technologies. We need to find out what the technologies that exist, how we put it to work. Across the state in renewable projects, and so again, I think I'd have to see the bill. I'd have to look at it to really make a decision or make it have an opinion on it. But this is a proven. I'm saying if you compare the two, this is a proven one. This has a solid track record. But the other one was only backed with it only had a few million dollars behind it. It wasn't many projects. It didn't have the following, shall I say, as this program does. So I'd have to see what a revised bill would look like. But
perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's dive in.
It's all yours.
Keep going. Sorry. So one really important component of the Renewable Energy Fund program is kind of our work in conjunction with the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee, which was created in statute as part of the program, and we work in very close cooperation with this committee in terms of deciding what projects we ultimately look to recommend to the legislature for funding. As well as other things, matters of policy for the program, whether we should, focus on, projects in certain phases over others, and kind of a general re-ranking of projects. Right, and as you can see here, four of the members of the committee are appointed by the respective legislative bodies. So you have, two from the Senate and two from the House. Both of which have yet to be appointed at this time. So just as a reminder, it's helpful for us to it's definitely helpful for us to have that to continue to keep the program moving as well as it does.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, and it's good to see you both here today in the House Energy Committee. In regards to your governance, and I see this as an advisory committee that's pretty structured in terms of its existing statute. On slide 3, you mentioned 5 different task forces or working groups, and I was curious to know how the working groups interface with AEA as a whole. And then I'm interested in, you had mentioned, Curtis, that you were thinking about starting a nuclear energy working group, and I wanted to know whether or not that was something that's happening soon.
Through the chair, I might have misspoke. On the nuclear piece, the university leads that effort. We are part of their working group on that, just because for what we look at in our public outreach and our working groups, we're looking at proven technology today and how we can apply them today. So nuclear doesn't fit into that box yet because it's still out, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, a micronuclear, that being. But with the working groups, we do meet regularly with those working groups. They provide insight into our programs, and some of them obviously have interest in REF projects or Renewable Energy Fund projects and such. And so it's a pretty cohesive group. And so we also learn from their projects that they're working on in rural Alaska or ones they would like to see funded. But again, we go through, which Connor will cover, we'll go through a pretty regimented process for the application. And one thing I want to thank with the legislature, and that is our system has been pretty foolproof in the sense that it's nice before people politically to move stuff around. It's just we rank them. We have a strict criteria. The Renewable Energy Advisory Committee reviews that. They approve that ranking, and then it's given to the legislature. And nobody questioned, and I'm saying nobody's really questioned it, not even the applicants or anybody, that we've ranked them in an order, and they're good programs. But some are better than others in the sense of what the cost of energy for that community and what it would do for a particular community lowering that cost. But I can jump back to that original slide. But those are our five working groups. But nuclear is one that we're a part of, but not one of the ones that we operate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
As far as the REF program is concerned, there are some guidelines within which we operate. And given the namesake of the program, programs must clearly be supportive of a renewable energy technology, or at least incorporate that. In some instances, we do receive applications for battery energy storage systems, BESS projects, by virtue of which are eligible because they do incorporate the energy from a renewable energy generation source. As you can see here, there is a carve-out for natural gas applications. In my tenure as a director of the program, I have not seen any applications come in for a natural gas project. So I can't speak to those applications that have been received under that carve-out.
Representative Kopp?
Yes. This question may be for you or Mr. Thayer. Do we know if any of these funds that applicants could apply for are frozen under the recent orders?
Through the chair, this is stately funded. There's no federal dollars attached to this, so this program is operational. And that there is a request to move some projects forward with the funding this year.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer.
Yep. Question,
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, how much of this program ties into the energy policy that was passed in 2010? The application process.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that is one of the kind of the foundational pieces when the program was set up that we tried to maintain. As far as what was done in 2010, there is also the governor's recent governor's energy task force does not have the enforcement of statute, but there was also a lot of recommendations in there that we also kind of look to that document too, not to make decisions from, but to look to see how things have changed, especially in the renewable, and how we affect stuff. And a lot of it is in rural Alaska, because there's ways that we might have thought or did stuff looking back at projects that we have maybe just a different eye to, or we have more information on as a whole, because there's so much more renewables. When this program was started in 2008, to have a solar farm in Alaska wasn't really heard of. Wind was new to Alaska, and now we're seeing that. So we've kind of made sure that the program evolves with the technologies that occur. So 2010 and forward, but as other guiding documents are there, they help provide insight for the program.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
What?
Yeah, that's definitely a topic for another day, but the energy policy and the progress made from 2010 to 2025, where we're at now, are vastly different worlds, diametrically opposed in a number of instances. But it would be interesting, and I'm sure on your long list of things to do in the committee, we will probably be taking a look at that topic, and perhaps, I know we have a gentleman across the table who is an expert on the task force report, all 210 pages of it, or whatever it is.
Especially that's it. Page 56, third
paragraph. Excellent.
Yes, thank you.
Please continue.
Actually, Let's go back just for a second. As far as applicant eligibility is concerned, it's fairly wide in the sense that so long as it generally you're a public agency or you're an IPP, then that is generally allowable under the program. IPPs is a matter to kind of ensure that that it is in fact to be an IPP. We generally do ask for attestations from applicants to state that, you know, would you otherwise not receive funding, would you still, you know, continue to pursue the project and, you know, look to become an IPP? That is a part of our process. As you can see, local governments and other government utilities or housing authorities are also eligible under the program. The REF evaluation process, as Curtis has attested to, is a pretty time-tested and robust and proven process that consists of four stages, the first one being kind of a general review of the application for its completeness, eligibility as far as the project is concerned, as well as the applicant. The second stage is an evaluation of the project, looking at it from a very technical perspective as well as economic and financial feasibility perspective. We do contract with third parties to conduct reviews of the projects as far as cost-benefit ratios are concerned, as well as looking at land use issues from the DNR. The third stage is a ranking of the projects and initially done by the authority internally. There's other aspects that are considered as a part of this stage. As you can see here, the cost of community energy, which is a ratio of the cost of energy to the median income of the particular community, as well as any matching funds that can be provided to that. And just to kind of caveat that point, matching funds are not a requirement of the program, although you can earn additional points as a part of the process if you are able to provide that. It can either be through in-kind or cash, so that doesn't necessarily we're trying to be equitable in terms of how that's applied. Project readiness is also something that we consider. How far along are you in the project in relation to the phase that you've applied for? Project sustainability in terms of, you know, what does it look like? How capable of is the applicant of operating the project into the future? And has there been, you know, other projects have been successful in perhaps other communities that are in close proximity, as well as the public benefit? That is something that we do take into a great consideration because as a fiduciary of state funds in the program, we do take that very seriously.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Kopp.
Would an example of a project like this be like Igeaugix In River Hydro, or maybe a Cook Inlet tidal turbine? Can you give us examples?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, that is correct. In fact, the Igeaugix project was funded as a project under the REF program. It did receive REF funding. There has been applications for tidal projects under the program. Generally, just due to the kind of nascent nature, as well as the ranking that's come out, and the kind of the feasibility of those, they tend to score somewhat lower than other more proven technologies. It's not to say that they aren't good projects, and this is kind of something that I'd like to just mention to kind of perhaps kind of dispel maybe some. Thoughts on the program is that the recommendations that we do provide are provided as a, you know, a part of our discussions with the REFAC, as well as none of the projects are bad projects. They're all recommended projects. It's just there is a ranking there too, but that doesn't that's not an indication of the fact that it's a bad project. Those projects, all the projects are vetted as a part of this process.
Follow up, Representative Allen.
Right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on those comments because they were kind of along the same lines of my interest here, and that is I'm looking for a little more clarification on how risk of the project technically is factors in, and from the standpoint of whether or not there's any bias to use this fund to help do some projects that might be a little riskier as opposed to just doing tried and true, because I think that's one of the benefits that this funding has allowed us to kind of move out beyond traditional projects. So I've got to imagine to some degree risk is okay in that area. I'm just curious how you think about that. And then the second half of that is energy diversification a positive or a negative factor for a community project ranking?
Through the chair, Chair Holland, great questions. I think to answer your first question, absolutely, that risk tolerance is something that we do consider, but it's by no means a final determination. There's been many instances, and I think to Representative Edgeman's comments earlier about the REF's support of kind of the renewable energy industry in Alaska and kind of looking to guide its trajectory into the future and kind of staving it from the brink. In the earlier years, we've definitely seen kind of a direction in terms of the technologies that are applied for. Looking and as a part of that, we kind of like took the risk earlier on, and then these projects have become de-risked as time has gone on. These projects have been proven to be effective in these areas. For example, in the earlier years of the program, there were a lot of projects that were funded to erect wind turbines in a lot of communities. And now you're seeing, solar in a lot of those same communities that are even, communities that are located in far northerly areas of the state, which are obviously shrouded in darkness for a majority of the year. But those projects, just given also the vast amount of sunlight that it's available to them during the summertime when loads are low, that allow the diesel generators to be turned off for those periods of time in which the insulation is sufficient. That's definitely been a boon to the program, and we've seen a lot of displacement as a result of that. So I think we've kind of seen those technologies come to light. In fact, I'll address it later in the presentation, but there is a project that's being proposed that is somewhat of a newer technology that could, be somewhat of a model for other communities as we move forward. But absolutely, the program is established that to provide funding for earlier stages. So we are not necessarily, I should say, as an authority, we don't look upon nascent technologies as something to be afraid of.
So I just want to do a time check. We've got a little bit more than a half an hour left, which in committee time can be a lot. But we've got a couple of more slides to get through before we get to round 17 in the list of projects, which I think is really important for the committee to understand what projects are there, because we need to decide how far to fund down the list. And even though this isn't the Finance Committee subcommittee on DCCED, we've got the opportunity here to be the most informed committee to be able to make the decisions and a recommendation of how far down the list to go. So I'd like to leave plenty of time to learn the projects today.
I will move through this quickly then. This slide just kind of gives a sense of what the funding limits are for a particular funding year, and it's actually the funding limits are based on a project basis. For some projects, they may apply in 1 year for a feasibility stage, prove out the project, come back and say, "Oh, we've looked at this. Now we'd like to fund it for construction." That's happened on several occasions. And it's definitely something that we find to be definitely a prudent approach, something which we promote under the program. This slide indicates what the past capitalization has been, appropriations from the legislature. So you can see, as Curtis stated earlier in the presentation, in the earlier years, the fund was funded at definitely higher levels. There were years in which, due to fiscal constraints, the program didn't receive any money at all. But it's definitely had a comeback here in recent years, and we'd like to extend our appreciation for that. Round 17 summary applications. This just provides a summary of the applications by the energy regions. So there's 9 energy regions for the state. So not all of those are represented here in round 17. And you know, that is something of note. I mean, clearly, we can't tell people to apply for specific things. So it's we're kind of subject to those applications that we receive. And so that, and it's just by virtue of what we receive, you know, is what comes through as being recommended in any given year. You can see also the technology as far as what's being requested tends to be in more recent year in recent years you've seen definitely an uptick in the applications for battery systems, solar and hydro projects. As you can see here, this is a geographical distribution of the projects that were received and are recommended as part of REF Round 17. So you can see there's a pretty big distribution in terms of you know where they fall across the state. Here's the first slide of the initial couple projects that are being recommended under REF Round 17. That orange line delineates those projects which are to be funded under the current within the governor's budget as proposed. So anything falling below that line would need to be funded at the discretion of the legislature. So the first one, the City of Pelican, the question to the chair is, do you want me to run through the projects one by one or... I guess to what extent would you like detail on the projects?
I'd like at least for the moment to do a brief description of the projects on this page, if we can get through that, and then see if there's more details that we want to dive into.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, for the record, we have a write-up on every 2 to 3 page write-up on all these. We just chose not to include it, but we can provide the committee with a complete write-up on each one of these that were scored
yes,
and their
please.
Application. So we can do that.
So the City of Pelican is actually a relicensing project for their hydro facility that they have down there. The city, owing to some past events, didn't have the necessary funds to allocate towards the relicensing process as required by FERC for their existing hydroelectric dam. That community is currently 100% fueled by that dam. So, you know, in the event that project goes unfunded, the community would then be 100% reliant on diesel, as they would not be allowed to operate that hydro project under federal law. The second project is a 1 megawatt solar and a 1.5 megawatt battery project on Cape Swornoff in the Naknek community. There is an existing solar array there, so that technology has been proven to be successfully incorporated within that community, and they've definitely showed that they can maintain and operate a system like that effectively. And so we've recommended funding for that project to go ahead. That third project, the Goat Lake Hydro, is a reconnaissance project. That's an existing hydro facility down in southeast Alaska that powers the communities of Skagway, Haines, and it's an AP Alaska Power and Telephone project. It'd be a similar project to the AEA's Dixon Diversion, where they'd be adding additional, doing a slight dam raise, adding additional water to that dam to leverage existing generation. The next project is the New Vista Wind and Battery Project. So that's a 400 kilowatt wind project and a 500 kilowatt battery project. That's being applied to for this one. This one is a there's four. They received money from the feds to put up 4 wind towers. When they went to go put up the wind, this project has been ongoing since 2020 to 2022. They sought to put up wind towers using the federal funds. When they went to go erect the towers, they noticed that there's faults in the lines that support the towers. They realized that as part of that, they couldn't So when the tower went up, it failed to go up. The project has kind of languished, and then costs have escalated as a result of supply side price pressures and other things, as well as the completion of energy stoves to utilize excess wind power as part of the project to maximize efficiency of those wind turbines. So it's as far as cost is concerned. It's really to kind of maximize to actually get the wind turbines working and operational, so that they don't have the base towers set there with no power coming from those, and to allow for the heating of homes in that community using the excess wind power. The next project is a BESS project. There's an existing wind farm in that community. They're looking to utilize that BESS project to allow for a greater diesel's off period, because even at this moment, even if the wind turbines are spinning, they still have to operate their diesels in order to provide spinning reserve in case the wind dips, and also to provide stability within the system. So that battery is going to allow for maximum return on the power supplied by those wind turbines. The city of Nenana, this is a final phase for their biomass district heating system. So this is to install a final biomass boiler and put in the final loops, which would displace about 46,000 gallons of heating oil per year for the city of Nenana. So it's a pretty substantial offset to the cost for that community. The next one is a 100-kilowatt solar project. It's 100-kilowatt in addition to an existing 100-kilowatt solar project that was funded under federal dollars. And so that was just kind of to say that they proposed that because they've already kind of put in the necessary operation systems that were needed for the initial solar array, if they could then kind of piggyback on that and add another 100-kilowatt system, that they could capitalize on those synergies and look to offset increased diesel.
So I just want to note that this is the first project that's below the recommended funding line in the governor's budget.
Correct.
So any project that we're doing on here, I think it's important to pay attention to and see how far we want to move that line down. Although I'm going to be honest, I'd love to see the line at the bottom of the list, but I'm not quite sure we're going to get there. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I'm just wondering if you could clarify for me on this table, as we go down below the line, how do we look at the data you've provided here in terms of the community benefit and savings? So if we go down one line and we spend another $720,000, I believe, what's the benefit that the community is getting out of that? Because I'm assuming there's a diminishing level of community benefit as we go down the list, that you've already ranked that in there. So really high community benefit to begin with, and then it goes down. How do I read this to understand the relative incremental community benefit of each next project?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Holland, that's a good question. To answer your question, the statement that there's an incremental reduction in the benefit contributed is not necessarily entirely accurate, in the sense that what we see in from a lot of communities, especially from rural communities, costs in rural communities tend to be higher than those in the railroad, just by virtue of their geographic location and difficulty in getting the supplies to where they are and hiring necessary labor to do the work in the community, versus what the displacement would be on a production basis. So you're going to see that ratio decrease, which is not necessarily something that you'd like to see, but it's just kind of the nature of those projects. But it's not to say, you can definitely see that there are rural projects above the line as well. Another thing to consider is that, these applications are submitted to reflect the needs of the community. We don't go out there, AEA does not go out there and say, hey, what is it that you need? They're coming to us saying, this is what we think that we need that's going to serve the best purposes of our community. It's hard to put a price tag on some of these things, but I think what we need to consider is the ability to kind of like leverage additional funding as well as looking at the household energy cost for that particular community. So you can see that they're displacing perhaps not as much fuel, but the cost of energy in that community is much greater. So the benefit to those residents might in fact be more improved.
A follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. I think I'm getting some of what you're saying, but let me try it slightly differently. If we take the next incremental project that's going to cost $1 million, to not pick out any one project for this question, is there an analysis that says the community and the ratepayers will save $1.1 million, so there's a net benefit to the state? We put $1 million in, the community gets $1.1 million savings, so the community, Alaska's better, versus we put $1 million into a project, but we only save the community $750,000. So we've kind of gone backwards $250,000. I'm trying to figure out how do we look at these projects, because I'd like to be able to go all the way down the list, like, you know, my co-chair is saying, but I'm assuming this list could be a mile long if we wanted to do it. And you know, and so how do we look at each incremental one in terms of the benefit that's coming to Alaska, to the community, to be able to assess the value of that next dollar spent on this project versus we could take those dollars and put them someplace else, like a high voltage DC line, or we could be using it to fund a school, or, you know, we've got dollars. We're trying to figure out the best use of the dollars. And so I'm trying to look at these lines, trying to see what's the value to that community for the amount of money we're spending.
Through the chair, Representative Vaughn, I think there's not a kind of single answer to your question. You know, the details, like Curtis said, on these projects probably would provide a much greater description as to, you know, the how we arrived at the ranking at which we did. I think what's also fair to consider is that, for instance, if you take the Alaska New Renewables project for $2 million, you know, we're looking at three sites at potentially over 200 megawatts apiece. So, I mean, and so when we look at, you know, if the state's going to invest $2 million, but then Alaska Renewables can run with that project and put in, you know, two, maybe they put them all in. So the benefit to the rail boat by producing clean and cheap wind is, you know, that far surpasses the amount of money that the state would have allocated to achieve that benefit. And obviously that cost would also offset cost to the ratepayers, because that's one less cost that would go into the project cost for the design that would be incorporated into the power purchase agreement.
Thank you. Let's please keep going down the list.
So we'll go to the next one, the railboat wind diversification. So this is a feasibility analysis to look at three more potential wind sites that Alaska Renewables is looking at. We funded them in a round 15 project that's looking at Shovel Creek and Little Mount Susitna. This is for Chattanooga, Bald Hills, and Walker Dome up in near the Fairbanks region. It's a feasibility project. So we kind of estimate based the gas displacement as well as energy production based on the preliminary design. The following project, the City Fund project, that's a fairly small scale project. As you can see, as far as the dollar amount is concerned, it's one of the lower dollar amounts. What that's looking at is installing a turbine within the city's municipal water system on a pressure release valve, and offsetting some of the operational costs to the municipality. So it's somewhat of a test project, and I think that has the potential for a lot of knowledge transfer within other municipalities within in Alaska as well. It's not an incredible amount of energy, but you know it could come at very little additional costs and good payback over the long term.
And just a note, I mean, Homer Electric is the first one. You know, we've got a month left before they're out of their natural gas contract. So, you know, being thoughtful about that and just noting that this and the previous project are the only ones contributing electrons to the rail belt energy grid. The Nanana project higher up the list is just district heat. So that's very site specific and very, very community specific. So just awareness. thank you. Please continue.
The next project is electronic thermal stove integration. So there's an existing wind farm up in at Etmutluk, And the thermal stoves are looking to harness the excess energy that's produced by the wind that can't be used by the community during times of peak wind production. But those thermal stoves they're directly fueled by the electricity that's generated by the wind turbine, so it can offset these heating oil used by residents within that community. The SEPA, or Southeast Alaska Power Agency project, is a project for a 12-megawatt third turbine. So in the same vein of Bradley Lake, the powerhouse was designed to have three bays, two of which are currently occupied, the third one, which remains empty at this time. But SEPA has seen their capacity reach its pretty effective limits due to increased demand over the years, as well as adoption of electric air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, as well as EVs within the region. So the communities of Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Metlakatla. So what they're doing is looking to add a third turbine to help in those instances of peak load, where they can use the third turbine to for peak shaving purposes. Instead of having to ask the individual communities to fire up their diesel generators, they can simply just turn that third turbine on and supply the needed power. And it also creates additional excess capacity for potential uses in the future as well.
So I wanted to ask a question about this. So this is kind of getting into some other issues. So I think this might be an area that is looking to expand with heat pumps. And with the heat pumps, there are more electrical demand. And would this project help that heat pump project then be more successful because there's more capacity by having that third generator on there?
Through the chair, that is correct.
So there's ancillary benefits. So it's not just providing that, but it is also expanding our opportunities in other areas.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you. So I just wanted to check in with the will of the committee. I'm really appreciating getting to know more about these projects. Are we still good to keep going down the list today? We got capacity to keep going on this?
Another 15 minutes, sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the committee time left, but I understand that, going through the projects is a lot as well. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So page 23 is a continuation of what is under the red line on 22. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Which is, which are not presently funded in the 26 budget, correct?
Correct.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Excellent. With that, let's take another 10 or so minutes on the project. And I appreciate you sharing with our offices a little bit more detail on them. But, the opportunity to ask clarifying questions like that is important. So thank you for the quick synopses.
My pleasure. Continuing on, the AVIC, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative AVIC project in Chivac, this is similar to the Quinnahock project that I previously went over. So this is a battery, a BESS system that would be implemented with its existing 400 kilowatt wind farm up there, which would allow the diesels to operate in more diesels off hours, as well as lower loading on those gensets to provide grid stability as well as necessary spinning reserve, so when the wind dips down that there's not risks of outages to the community. The next one down is the Knutson Creek Hydro Project. It's a fairly small hydro project, but the community is also of a small population and it is largely based on commercial fishing. So the load demand is in the summertime. It is a run-of-river project, so there is no storage aspect to it, but it is anticipated to displace about 98% of the fuel needs for that community throughout the year. So even in times of the winter when there'd be low flows, but the demand would be fairly low as well for the community, so that would be able to satisfy the needs during that time. The next one is Akiyachak. This is a 200 kilowatt solar energy project. This would augment an existing 200 kilowatt energy solar project that was funded through a federal grant. So this is, again, adding to additional capacity that's already within the community. There's already BESS in that community, so this is just taking some additional funds and being able to further augment their ability to produce power from solar energy. The next one is from this Nome utility. It's a proposal to install a 1 megawatt solar farm up on a location where there already is an existing about a 2 megawatt wind project. The city also has a battery in place, so that system is looking to help provide increased stability during the summertime when there's lower wind regimes. Times at which the wind isn't blowing sufficiently to power the turbines. But this will be able to also provide for lower loading of the gensets to provide for a greater diesel fuel displacement as well as greater periods of potential diesels off time as well. The next project is the Hunter Creek Hydroelectric Project, which is a run-of-river project in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. It's a feasibility project, so there as part of the project they'd be investigating, you know, what would the optimal size would be, as well as siting and design for the particular project, and it would be offsetting the consumption of natural gas because it would be within the rail belt. That project would be owned by the Matanuska Electric Association, so it would be integrated within their existing system. You can see there would be about 27,000 megawatt hours displaced. It's a fairly small size, but I think again this is just a feasibility component. So there is potential for that project to increase in size depending on what the results of those studies are. The next one is the Chignik, City of Chignik. This is a further Indian Lake Hydro Project. The City of Chignik did receive federal funding for their hydro project. This would be helping to provide a match to that project. There's a required cost match to that. That funding is presently on pause, as with all the other ones, but we don't anticipate there being continued risk at this time. We do feel as though there would be just a pause. But we will wait and alert you to any updates if there are any to that project. The final one is a solar project down in the Kenai Peninsula. This is for a smaller a similar project that would be of a similar scope to the Puppy Dog Lake project, selling solar power to Homer Electric. a 3.2 megawatt project, so about at a tenth of the size of the one that would be that's currently under development, so as a part of that, though, they'd be finishing up the final design as well as the construction. That would be located on an existing landfill owned by the Kenai Peninsula Borough. As you can see here, this is just kind of a summary of all projects that have ever been funded under the REF program. So you can kind of see here how they're distributed across the different.
We've moved on to another slide.
Oh, sorry,
that was me.
Some questions.
I'm
here.
The clock. I'm with you,
Representative Rauscher. Get a pause there for a moment.
Thank you, through the chair. Okay, so 18 projects, 1 through 18, 17 recommendations. Should it have said 18 recommendations, or is one not a recommendation?
I believe
there are supposed to be 18 recommendations.
There should be 18 recommendations on that list. Is there only 17?
It says 17.
Round 17.
These are these are 18 recommendations for REF round 17. I don't know if it's.
Is that how it works? Okay, mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand how that works because didn't understand it.
All righty. Anybody have any other questions on the projects today?
Just a quick question,
Representative Holland.
Just on the table here, because I want to go back and study it some more. The HEC column. Could you clarify for me again what HEC is and that dollar amount that we see for each project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the household energy costs. So that's a combination of both electrical and heating costs for that community. It's a reflection of the annual expenditure of a resident for to satisfy their needs.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Now on to slide 24. Thank you.
So as you can see here, this is just kind of provides a little bit more evidence to the general equitable distribution of the funds across the different regions of the state that AEA classifies. The reason for the North Slope and as a small percentage is because of their access to natural gas via the North Slope. So in my tenure as director of the program, I have not seen a single application come in through from that region. Again, even though the authority looks to provide funding on an equitable basis across all energy regions, we are limited in terms of what we're able to recommend based on the applications that we do receive in any given year. And this is kind of an interesting slide. At least I think it really speaks volumes, at least to the efficacy of the program in terms of what it's done for the state as a whole in terms of being able to successfully integrate and implement renewable energy projects across the state and save communities hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars over the course of the program in terms of fuel costs. So you can see that on an annual basis, right now we're displacing over 13 million gallons of diesel every year.
And just a clarification on that: this is just diesel fuel. Like disbursement. So if you've got a small community that's got water and sewer lines that are reliant on either hydronics or electric heat tape to keep from being frozen, there's additional cost to a community for not having reliable power. So by adding on additional sources of electrons or whatever is being provided here, there's other costs of the savings that we're not even looking at here.
Through the chair, that is correct. And Representative Holland's prior question related to whether we consider technologies in conjunction with one another and whether or not that provides additional benefits. So if you would have, say, wind and solar, yes. I mean, we that is something that we also consider because those two technologies, while different in both but also in both intermittent, do provide benefits. So you could conduct, say, necessary repairs for a diesel gen set during times at which you might be able to provide that power through other means like the wind and solar, and so without having to take the diesel engines offline and create a potential risk to the community.
Or if you've got more solar in the summer and you've got a BESS system, then you're able to not have diesel running at all that for a number of days. So complementing those technologies allows for that, and not having spinning reserves is really good for not needing that is really good for diesel consumption. Coach Holland.
Thanks. Through the chair, I'm curious whether or not you've done any analysis and have a report that I could find that's already there about the historical benefits that you're learning now in terms of which projects have really paid off well and what those benefits are that might be allowing us to learn some lessons on the technologies and which ones are the winners and which ones are the ones that maybe need to be done differently next time. But I'm particularly interested in how we can use that information to help leverage the investment, to put more investment into this if we could see the long-term results where we come back and say, wow, this one paid off big for us. Is that information available?
Through the chair, that information is available, perhaps not in such a easily digestible format, but I do on our website we do post all the projects that we've ever funded, what the nameplate capacity, what it displaces in a given year, what the technology is, and you can see the status of the project. So whether that was one that ultimately didn't pan out to anything, or if it is in operation as of today. So that information is all available on our website under the REF program. Additionally, there was an impact. We did do an impact analysis for the program in 2022, so that does provide some additional testament as to the success of the program. And there are some additional notes on benefits of the program as a result of appropriations.
Mr. Chair, we can provide that information.
That would be great. I'm looking for ways to help sell the benefit, and if we've got something that says we put a dollar in here and we got over the lifetime $10 out on this kind of project, it'd give everyone more confidence in the investment.
Thank you. Do committee members have any follow-up questions?
I appreciate the presentation.
Yes, thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this presentation for a long time, and it's nice to have that very shortly after the results were available. Thank you for having all that in your head to share with us from the slides. That's a lot of information, and it's really appreciated. The next meeting of the House Energy Committee will convene at 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 18th. The committee will hear from a Cook Inlet update from DNR with a number of topics in it. And as a friendly reminder, the DCCED budget subcommittee will meet 12:30 on Tuesday before our committee here. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:57 p.m.